We've been working our way through the story of Joseph. This is the second week, but the third lesson. And that's because last Sunday, I gave you part one and part two in the morning and the afternoon. And now we're going to continue through this series in the afternoons with part three today. But just to review where we've come so far, we started in Genesis chapter 37, where Joseph is introduced to us. And we saw how his brothers sold him to Midianite or Ishmaelite traders, who then sold him to Potiphar in Egypt. And then in Genesis 39, we saw how Joseph rose to prominence in Egypt, how he rose to prominence in Potiphar's house. And it was just when it seemed like things in his life had turned around that he had everything ripped out from under his feet again. In Genesis 39, he's falsely accused by Potiphar's wife and ends up in prison. And a major theme that we've already noticed in the life of Joseph is how God can use terrible circumstances to bring about good things. Over and over again, it seems like everything just happens terribly. But in fact, Joseph is right where he needs to be. And God uses those terrible circumstances to produce something great. And that is a theme in Joseph's story, but it's also a theme in the gospel. How God takes something as awful as the death of his son and brings about something as wonderful as salvation for us. And so as we talk about the story of Joseph, we are trying to see the practical applications for ourselves. Joseph is a great role model in a lot of different ways, but ultimately we want our attention to land on not the story of Joseph, but the story of Jesus, because Joseph points us to Christ in so many different ways. And so as we pick up here in chapter 40, we'll find Joseph where Potiphar left him, which is in prison. And I'll just admit to you, I wasn't sure whether to try to do 40 or 40 and 41 today, but I settled on chapter 40 alone because I think there's a lot of good applications that we can draw out of this, and I wanted to give us time to consider those. So let's begin here in Genesis chapter 40 and verse 1. If you'd like to, you can open your Bibles to follow along. It says, "Sometime after this, the cupbearer of the king of Egypt and his baker committed an offense against the Lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, and he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, in the prison where Joseph was confined. The captain of the guard appointed Joseph to be with them, and he attended them. They continued for some time in custody. And one night they both dreamed. The cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison, each his own dream, and each dream with its own interpretation. When Joseph came to them in the morning, he saw that they were troubled. So he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him in custody in his master's house, 'Why are your faces downcast today?' They said to him, 'We have had dreams, and there is no one to interpret them.' And Joseph said to them, 'Do not interpretations belong to God? Please tell them to me.'" Now, I think we see a number of good qualities in Joseph right here in these opening scenes of this chapter. The first thing that we might notice is just how diligent Joseph is. Joseph is a diligent worker. He's diligent to do his best in whatever circumstances he finds himself in. And God, I think, uses his diligence to help him to prosper. It turns out that when you do your best, a lot of times things tend to work out for you. And that's not at all to take away from God's influence or God's blessing of Joseph, but because Joseph is a diligent worker, he's faithful, he's reliable, there are many times where he wins the favor of the people that he works for. And so just like when he was in Potiphar's house and he did what Potiphar asked him to and gained Potiphar's favor, now that he's in prison, he does what the keeper of the prison asks him to do and he gains his favor as well. And you might notice some of those parallels. In chapter 39 in verse 4, It said Joseph found favor in Potiphar's sight, and he attended to him. In chapter 40 and verse 4, it says the captain of the guard appointed Joseph to be with them, and he attended them. And so wherever he was, he attended to his responsibilities. He attended to the needs that were in front of him. And this continues for some time until one night these prisoners who Joseph is in charge of have some dreams. And these prisoners are called the cupbearer and the baker. These would have been two of Pharaoh's chief officers who had very important responsibilities. And we don't know exactly how they landed in prison, but verse 1 tells us that they had committed an offense against Pharaoh. I think it's reasonable that there had maybe been some kind of attempt to poison Pharaoh, and maybe there were security checks that should have caught that attempt earlier. And so the two chief people responsible would be the ones in charge of his food and his drink, the baker and the cupbearer. Maybe it's something like that, maybe it's something else. But for whatever reason, both of these people are being held in prison. And Joseph comes to them one morning, and he sees that they look upset. And in verse 7, he asks them, he says, "Why are your faces downcast today?" I think that shows us a second good quality of Joseph, and that is that he's compassionate. Joseph cares when he notices that people's faces look downcast. He sees people who look upset, and he wants to know what's going on and how he can help. I think it would have been pretty easy for Joseph to ignore people like that. I mean, don't forget, Joseph himself is in prison. Joseph himself is a prisoner. Prison is not a very happy place for anybody. And so for Joseph to notice other people who are downcast, I think says something about the way that he thinks. Instead of wallowing in his own self-pity, he chooses to have concern for others. I wonder if that's part of what made Joseph so resilient in all of his difficult circumstances. You ever noticed how miserable it is to wallow in your own self-pity? It's easy to feel sorry for yourself. It's easy to just feel overwhelmed with the way that you feel about your circumstances. But if you can get outside of yourself and just start looking at the needs of others, it allows you to gain a lot of persistence, a lot of endurance. And maybe that's part of Joseph's secret, that he is able to focus on the needs of others instead of feeling sorry for himself. And so in verse 8, these prisoners tell Joseph, "We have had dreams, and there is no one to interpret them." And Joseph says to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Please tell them to me." A third good quality that we might notice in Joseph right here is his humility. Joseph is willing to do everything that he can to help, but he's quick to give the glory to God. And notice the way this humility works. When Joseph realizes that there's a need that he has the ability to help with, he says, "Let me help you get strength from God." And I think that's a really good mentality for us to have too, is that we recognize the opportunities that God gives us, we recognize the abilities that God gives us, but we want him to get the glory. We want him to get the credit for whatever it is that we do. I've mentioned this quote a few times, but this is something I keep coming back to. It's something that C.S. Lewis wrote in Mere Christianity. He wrote, "Humility is not thinking less of yourself, but thinking of yourself less." And I think there's a lot of truth in that. And I think you see that demonstrated right here in Joseph. Notice, Joseph isn't bashful about his ability to interpret dreams. He doesn't try to downplay that. He doesn't try to pretend like he doesn't have the abilities that he has. But he recognizes that the abilities that he has are gifts from God. It reminds me a little bit about the way Paul reasons with the Corinthians, when he talks to them and he says, "What do you have that you have not been given?" In other places, when we think about the gifts that we have, the talents or the abilities, and how we might use them for the edification of the church, to serve each other, we're reminded that these are gifts that God has given us. And so there's nothing wrong with acknowledging that we might have gifts. And the gifts that I have might be different than the gifts that you have. But whatever talents you have, whatever abilities you have, whatever gifts God has given you, you can use them not for your glory, but for His. And that's what Joseph wants to do. He wants to use his ability to interpret these dreams to point their attention to God, to say He is the one who has this power. Well, let's see their dreams now in the next section. In verse 9, it says, "So the chief cupbearer told his dream to Joseph and said to him, 'In my dream there was a vine before me, and on the vine there were three branches. As soon as it budded, its blossoms shot forth, and the clusters ripened into grapes. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's cup and placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand.' Then Joseph said to him, 'This is its interpretation. The three branches are 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office, and you shall place Pharaoh's cup in his hand as formerly, when you were his cupbearer. Only remember me when it is well with you, and please do me the kindness to mention me to Pharaoh, and so get me out of this house. For I was indeed stolen out of the land of the Hebrews, and here also I have done nothing that they should put me into the pit.' When the chief baker saw that the interpretation was favorable, he said to Joseph, 'I also had a dream. There were 3 cake baskets on my head, and in the uppermost basket there were all sorts of baked food for Pharaoh, but the birds were eating it out of the basket on my head.' And Joseph answered and said, 'This is its interpretation. The 3 baskets are 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from you and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat the flesh from you.'" So this is a very interesting pair of dreams, and it's interesting how they compare and contrast with each other. So first of all, notice the repeated emphasis on the number 3. The cupbearer dreams about this vine that has 3 branches. The baker dreams about 3 baskets of cake. And in both interpretations, this has something to do with their heads being lifted up in 3 days. But that's what leads to the contrast. Their heads are going to be lifted up in very different ways. In verse 13, the cupbearer will be lifted up and restored to his office, which is to be at Pharaoh's throne. But the baker, in verse 19, will have his head lifted up from his body and hung on a tree. Most people who study these things say that that means that he was to be beheaded and then impaled on a pole. And so, not exactly the interpretation the baker was hoping for, especially after the cupbearer had a much more favorable one. But so look at how the story concludes here in these last few verses. It says in verse 20, "On the 3rd day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, he made a feast for all his servants and lifted up the head of the chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his servants. He restored the chief cupbearer to his position and he placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker, as Joseph had interpreted to them. Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him." So notice everything goes exactly the way Joseph predicted that it would. 3 days later, Pharaoh decides that his birthday party is the perfect occasion to make a spectacle out of his servants. For one of them, he makes a great display of mercy. For another one, he makes a great display of wrath. The cupbearer is treated as innocent, and he is restored to his position of glory. But the baker is treated as guilty and lifted up to die on a tree. Now, remember, Joseph asked the cupbearer to remember him in verse 14, which I think shows us that Joseph was very confident that his interpretation would come true. He didn't ask the baker to remember him. That wouldn't have done him very much good. But he asked the cupbearer to remember him when he was freed from the prison. But in verse 23, it says, "Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him." If you were to peek ahead into chapter 41, what you would see is that two whole years go by before Joseph is remembered by anybody at all. It kind of reminds me of Paul in Acts chapter 24. If you remember when Felix kept him in prison, he kept him there for two whole years until he was succeeded by Porcius Festus. And so prison is an easy place for people to get forgotten. Paul ends up being forgotten in prison for 2 years, just like Joseph here in Genesis chapter 40. But even so, Joseph is exactly where he needs to be. It may not look like it, and that is the theme of Joseph's story, is that over and over again, it seems like there's no way that this can work out for good. He's in a terrible place. He's in a terrible position. Things have not gone well for him, but over and over again, we see that God has him exactly where he wants him. And in the next chapter, it's not Pharaoh's servants who have dreams that need to be interpreted, but it's Pharaoh himself. And at just the right time, Joseph's talents will again be requested. So that's a pretty short chapter, and I think it's one that we're probably fairly familiar with. But like I said, I think there's a lot of good applications that we can take from this, and a lot of good ways that we ought to see Jesus. There are three main figures in this chapter: Joseph, the cupbearer, and the baker. And I'd like to make the case that all three of them actually point us to Christ. First of all, we noticed Joseph's diligence, his compassion, and his humility in this story. Jesus is actually the perfect example of all three of those qualities. From a very young age, we see the diligence of Jesus. In Luke chapter 2, we see him at 12 years old. It's the only story that we have of Jesus in his youth. But he was in the temple, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. And if you recall, his parents lost him and didn't realize it until they had made their way out of the city. But they double back and they look for him. And when they find him there in those religious studies, they ask him why he had gone. And he said in Luke 2 and verse he said there in Luke 2, "Did you not know that I must be in my Father's house?" I think what we see is that Jesus felt compelled to honor God at every opportunity he had. It wasn't merely something that he felt like was his duty or his responsibility, but it was also something that he desired to do. He was the kind of person, when there were spiritual conversations happening, he leaned in. He didn't pull away. And in Luke 2:52, it goes on to say, "Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man." And so I have to imagine that Jesus did his best at everything that he did. When he did carpentry work with his father, I'm sure he did it with all of his might. I'm sure he made the best tables and chairs and whatever else Joseph needed to make. But when he studied the scriptures, he would have applied himself fully to knowing them as well. Jesus was a diligent worker in everything that he did, and he applied that diligence in his ministry. When we see the way that Jesus lived in his ministry, we see that he often woke up early. He often stayed up all night. He taught people and he healed people when he was worn out, when he was exhausted. Some have estimated that he walked over 3,000 miles during those final 3 years. And then in Luke chapter 9 in verse 51, it says, "When the days drew near for him to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem." When I think about the diligence of Jesus, I see somebody who was consistently determined to do what he was supposed to do. He did it when he was tired. He did it when he was discouraged. He just kept going on because he was working for the Lord. And so Joseph is a good example of diligence for us in all the work that he found to do, but Jesus models diligence even better. Secondly, Jesus was also the model of compassion. Remember, we saw Joseph showing compassion to the cupbearer and the baker in prison. He was attending to their needs. He was asking them why they were upset. He was giving his attention to them. Jesus did things like that too. You can look over in Matthew chapter 14. Matthew chapter 14 and verse 13. This is directly after Jesus finds out that John the Baptist had been put to death. And you might recall that John was not only Jesus' friend, he was somebody that he had a high degree of respect for. He said there's been no one born of woman like John. But he was also his cousin. And in Matthew 14 and verse 13, it says, "Now when Jesus heard this, he withdrew from there in a boat to a desolate place by himself." I wonder what he was doing in that boat. Maybe he was praying. Maybe he was crying. But it says, "When the crowds heard it, they followed him on foot from the towns. And when he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them and healed their sick." How easy do you think it would have been for Jesus to just think, "This isn't really a good time for me. You know, I'm just really worn out. I've had a lot going on. I'm not in the right frame of mind. I just need some space." But the thing that drove Jesus to continue to minister to the needs that he saw was his compassion. His heart was moved by the needs of others. Another good example is in John chapter 4. In John chapter 4, we see Jesus traveling, and we see that he grows physically tired. And in verse 5, it says, "He came to a town of Samaria called Sychar, near the field that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there. So Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well. It was about the sixth hour." Again, this might not seem like the ideal time to get into a spiritual conversation with somebody. You know, it'd be kind of like you've worked a long day and you're in line at the grocery store and you just want to get your groceries and go home. But then you overhear somebody saying something that makes you think, "This is an opportunity for me to share the gospel with somebody." What would you do? It sure would be easy to pretend you didn't hear. It sure would be easy to just say, "Now's not a good time, I'm too tired." But in verse 7, here comes this woman from Samaria to draw water. And Jesus opens up this conversation with her by saying, "Give me a drink." And for the rest of this chapter, he discusses the spiritual needs of this woman. He talks with her about the gospel. Compassion drove Jesus to constantly think about others. Over and over again, we see him having a genuine concern for the poor, for the helpless, for the suffering. He was moved not only to feel something, but to do something for others. And of course, all of that culminates in his sacrifice on the cross. 1 John 3 and verse 16 says, "By this we know love, that he laid down his life for us." But thirdly, Jesus is also the model of humility. In John chapter 8 and verse 50, Jesus says, "I do not seek my own glory." That's really what humility is all about. It's about doing what's right, but wanting God to get the glory for it. It's about using the talents and the abilities and the gifts and the opportunities that we have, but wanting people to glorify God for the good things that we do. Joseph interpreted these prisoners' dreams, but he wanted them to know that it was interpretations that belonged to God. He wanted God to get the credit for what he did. And that describes Jesus perfectly. Philippians chapter 2, in verse 5. Here we see the humility of Christ described, where it says, "Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. And being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross." Humility is about condescension. It's about lowering yourself and not seeing any need as being too low for you to respond to. And no matter what kinds of needs we might need to respond to, how we might need to sacrifice our preferences or our comforts or our time in order to do good for others, none of us will stoop down so low as Jesus stooped. One who was equal with God, coming down to the earth, humbling himself to the point of death on a cross. And so when we see the diligence and the compassion and the humility of Joseph, we ought to see the even greater diligence, compassion, and humility of Jesus. And it should be a good motivation for us to learn to mirror the same qualities in ourselves. But there were two other people in that story. In Genesis 40, we read about those two prisoners, the cupbearer and the baker. One of the prisoners is released, the other is executed. It sort of reminds me of Barabbas and Jesus. There were two prisoners, one was released, the other was put to death. And like the baker, Jesus was lifted up to hang on a tree. Isn't it interesting that that's the language that we read about in Genesis 40? That baker was hanged on a tree. He was lifted up and hanged on a tree. We see that kind of language applied to Jesus in Galatians chapter 3. In Galatians chapter 3 and verse 13, it says, "Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. For it is written, 'Cursed is everyone who is hanged on a tree.'" Here, Paul quotes from Deuteronomy 21 in verse 23 to emphasize the terrible death that Jesus died for us. To be hanged on a tree was to be abandoned by God in the eyes of people. It was humiliating. And so when Jesus was crucified on the cross, Paul connects that to being hanged on a tree. He emphasizes the terrible death that Jesus died for us. But in John chapter 12, Jesus also talked about his death as being lifted up. In verses 32 and 33, he said, "And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself." And verse 33 adds, "And this he said about the death that he was going to die." And so like the baker, Jesus was lifted up. He was hanged on a tree. He was hung on the cross. But the cupbearer, I would say, prefigures Jesus too. Because in Genesis chapter 40, we see that after 3 days, he was vindicated. After 3 days, the cupbearer came out of the prison, and he was exalted. He was lifted up and restored to his rightful position at the king's throne. Jesus was in the prison of the tomb, but on the third day, he was raised. And by his resurrection, he was vindicated. Romans chapter 1 and verse 4 says he was declared to be the Son of God in power. And now he's returned to his rightful position, exalted at the right hand of God. It's interesting. You have those two prisoners. Both are lifted up. One is lifted up in death, another is lifted up in glory. And Jesus, I think, shows us the fulfillment of both of those pictures. The cupbearer was restored to his rightful position at the right hand of the king. And now Jesus has been exalted to the right hand of the throne of God. I don't know if it's just a coincidence that this story is about a baker and a cupbearer. But one is a maker of bread, the other is a maker of wine. Together, those are the elements of the Lord's Supper. And in Jesus, the fates of the baker and the cupbearer come together. Jesus was lifted up to death, and Jesus was lifted up to glory. And it's because of his death and resurrection that we have hope. You know, when we read stories like this, I think it helps us to not only see the good examples that are there, but also to appreciate the source of the wisdom that is written for us. When we see the way that these stories prefigure Jesus, I think it helps us to appreciate that what we are looking at is one unified story in the Bible that points to Jesus in so many different ways. And clearly, there is an invitation in all of this for us. That if we will learn to see who Jesus is, that we could come to participate in the salvation that he offers, knowing that he is the Messiah, knowing that he is the Son of God of prophecy, knowing that it is in him that we too can be raised from the dead and be where he is at the right hand of God. And I hope that as we continue to think about Jesus, that it gives you more and more confidence in the salvation that only he can offer. That though your sins be as scarlet, they can become as white as snow.